How's it going?
Going good. How are you today?
I am doing fabulous. Thank you very, very much for coming on the pod. Before we really jump into it, I want to hear your 30-second elevator pitch that you have for Bitcoin. You have 30 seconds, minute. What do you say to someone to sell them on Bitcoin?
That's a great, great question. I think, a bus conversation. Hey, have you ever heard about Bitcoin? Have you heard about how inflation happens and how we print money out of thin air? And that's pretty much how it started.
Yeah.
It's kind of silly. Yeah.
Nothing very specific,
but inflation hits everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, I think it's best for people to come to the realization themselves. You know, it's not like you can say the correct sequence of words and automatically convert them. You know, they gotta realize it themselves. But yeah, fair enough. So you recently landed a job with Unchained Capital. You have the Ledger Chronicles going on. You have been a speaker at a few Bitcoin events around the world, and I guess you're a physics enthusiast as well. So number one, we'll touch on all this, but tell me about Unchained. It's the new job. I mean, let me hear it.
Thank you so much. And I did wanted to say I am honored to be one of your first guests here at the podcast. Thank you for having me. And yes, so I've been with Unchained for about a month now. And I mean, it feels like a dream. I've been around, I've been exposed to Unchained for as long as I've been exposed to Bitcoin, and they truly were the people who kind of gap the bridge between complex topics, making it super accessible for me. So it still feels like a dream. It's still, thank you for congratulating me, but yeah, just very lucky and happy to be there.
Yeah, yeah. So for the listeners, what exactly does Unchained do?
Awesome. So they are a self-custody Bitcoin company, specifically a multi-signature strategy company. So they basically make it easy for you to safely store your Bitcoin in the safest way possible. They do have other services. If you live in the United States, you can trade, for example. You can get a commercial loan that is denominated in Bitcoin. But I think the main focus is those multi-signature self-custody vaults.
Yeah, the collaborative custody.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I guess, what is your role then? I saw you were the customer care sales rep. Sorry, what was your title?
Yes.
What exactly are you doing?
So I'm a custody support associate. And okay, what I do is pretty much throughout the day, people will come to us with questions, with concerns. And it can be as simple as, you know, what is a key to, hey, how do I restore my whole multi-signature wallet with Sparrow or any of the sorts? And so in my position, I just help people understand and kind of guide them and meet them where they're at. Which is why I say, like, it's such a dream. To begin with, like, working in Bitcoin was one of my biggest dreams in the last 2-3 years. So to be doing that every day is honestly very rewarding in that sense.
Yeah. Oh, that's great to hear. That is great to hear. What are, like, what would you say is the most common question that people have?
Oh, that's a great question. So I've been there for a month, so I can't really speak for a lot of people, but I think it's all about holding their keys. So we are very self-custody advocate oriented. So most people, I don't want to call out most people out there or anything of the sorts, but there's still a lot of people who have their Bitcoin on exchanges, right? Or who, you know about Bitcoin and they think they're investing in Bitcoin, but oh wow, it's just this random other project and they don't know anything about that. So most of the questions I think comes to understanding how does Bitcoin work? Like, how to send a transaction on the actual Bitcoin network and not some built-in exchange that has paper receipts. So any of those, you know, how do I create a seed phrase and how do I store it correctly? A lot of people have that question, and it seems very basic, but it's an experience that has humbled me a lot because we are so early, and we're so early.
Fair enough. That's, oh my gosh, that does seem like, listen, if you've always wanted to enter Bitcoin, that seems like it seriously must be like surreal, honestly.
Totally. So, it's very rewarding.
Yeah. I mean, let's get into you a little bit. So what got you into Bitcoin? Were you in search of sound money, or did you start looking at NFTs a couple years ago and you switched sides? What got you here?
Oh, I was honestly very lucky that I didn't stay with the, you know, kind of shitcoin NFT situation for too long. I did for a little bit, kind of invested in this thing called Bcoin or something like that. I cannot even remember the name.
I haven't heard of it.
Yeah, for a moment there, I didn't understand that there was no second best. And I was like, oh, but what if this other thing one day will be better than this? Because I understood eventually. But I guess like my story really comes from I always wanted to see the world get better. I think everybody, most people do. And I thought as a kid that studying economics and kind of, you know, going and chasing after that political rush was going to make an impact in the world. But pretty soon then, I realized that was not the way to change anything meaningful. You know, if you don't change the system will just keep reinforcing the same patterns. So I kind of got a little disillusioned there and got kind of lost track of all my goals. And my goal really was to provide value to this world in any way possible. So later on in my life, I had a person that I really care about go into Bitcoin, and I've said this a couple times now, but I was incredibly skeptical, and I thought that my friend was going to lose all his savings. I was like, man, you're wrong. Like, tell what is wrong with that? And he literally sent me all the Bitcoin standard and all his resources. So it didn't took me long to verify that Bitcoin was the way to go and was the only thing probably in my lifetime that was going to actually create the impact that I wanted to see, even before knowing that Bitcoin was going to be Bitcoin. So yeah, as soon as I learned about Bitcoin, I joined the Victoria Bitcoin Club, which at the time was the crypto club. Big congratulations and shout out to the Victoria Bitcoin Club for changing the name finally.
When did they make that change?
Oh, it was a super short ago, maybe like a month.
A month
and a half, yeah. Yeah.
Congrats.
thank you so much. But yeah, that was the beginning of it. I would also, since we're here, I would like to know how did you got into Bitcoin as well, honestly.
Yeah, well, I mentioned there were two paths to Bitcoin. Really, honestly, this is kind of what I found. Some people are in search of the sound money. Some people are in search of the quick gains, the meme coin money. And honestly, I was the meme coin money. Kind of became Bitcoin crypto curious back in 2017. Bought a little bit of ETH back then. Mm-hmm. Honestly, has not moved much since. It was pretty much the top of the market.
Moved down.
Yeah. I mean, I've learned so much since then. And then it really wasn't until earlier last year when I heard about Solana and Solana meme coins. I had a couple buddies who made kind of a crazy amount of money and I got hooked. So played around in the trenches. And then again, just kept learning more and more and more and more. And it's led me to Bitcoin. It really has. I will say, though, I do still participate in the other side. I'm not a total maximalist at this point. I still am in the trenches.
No, that is all right. I don't judge you. You know, it's not Bitcoin. It's not Bitcoin.
Oh, no, it's probably worse.
So I've been there. And we all got to learn. We all got to grow. We all have our learning curve.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, you hear, like, the common Bitcoiner reasoning for why you shouldn't be in the crypto space is just because, I mean, one, it's just so unimportant and there's such bigger things going on with Bitcoin. But two, like 90% of traders in the crypto side aren't going to outperform just holding Bitcoin, you know? So I don't know the stat on that. Someone could probably search that up, but I mean, honestly, at this point, I think it's still worth playing around in that side, but honestly, long term, I'm Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have much to say other than, you know, if then you would have a lot more money to invest in Bitcoin, to put in Bitcoin.
That's honestly that's the goal.
Yeah, that's the way I'd see it. You know, sometimes those trades can actually make a little difference in the Bitcoin you get to hold. And I'm not a full coiner, but I do want to be there. And so I think that, yeah, there's a lot of little things that I would give up to have a full Bitcoin there.
Like what? What would you give up?
Maybe I would, yeah, as you, like, the reason I'm saying this is because maybe I would do a little of, I am so sorry, but a little of those kind of a little meaningless trades that could lead to owning more Bitcoin in the future. I guess you can tell that I am a maxi a little bit. I don't want to confess that. I don't want to out myself, but I, hearing myself, I might be a maxi.
You might be. But if the right meme coin opportunity presents itself, it's a 10x lock.
Yeah.
You might.
I mean, you know what? Like, I did roast it a lot of Dodge, for example.
Okay.
And I would have never seen the appreciation that we saw, you know, the last couple of days and the week before. And Elon Musk has a big influence in everybody else. So I might have been wrong with that one. It might have been a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, shoulda, coulda, woulda, but no, that's great. So would you consider yourself a Bitcoin maximalist? Just hearing yourself speak?
Yes. Just hearing myself, I do confess I'm a Bitcoin maximalist. I think I might accept a couple penny trades if it came to maybe getting more Bitcoin sooner, but that's about it for me.
Yeah. Would you say you're the type of Bitcoin maximalist who doesn't care about Bitcoin's price? Because you're in it for such a long haul, the volatility and price today doesn't matter. Because I know a few people like that.
Oh, I am. I am 100%. You know, I don't say how much Bitcoin I own. I've said here, I'm not a full coiner, but all my savings are in Bitcoin. And I don't care if it goes down because I do know and have faith that it really doesn't matter. And yeah, as you've heard me say, I think I'm in Bitcoin to make the world a better world. I'm not there to make me rich. So yeah.
Be the change you want to see in the world. That's great. And honestly, I do feel the same way. Like playing around in the trenches, there's always a thought looming over me of, there are such bigger things going on right now in Bitcoin. What are you doing wasting your time with this? So yeah, I'm heading more and more to that path, but yeah, fair enough.
That's all right. Yeah, I think, you know, and like, we all live different lives and we all have different purposes and priorities. And I think as long as everybody stays true to what you actually believe in, like, there's no wrong way to go.
Absolutely. So let me ask you a question. What do you think are Bitcoin's biggest hurdles to widespread adoption?
Yeah, that's a honestly, that's such a great question. Because I do think there's kind of two angles. I think that Bitcoin's biggest hurdle right now is that it's a little technical to self-custody, right? Like you have to at least know how to use your browser, for example. And there's a lot of people out there that just don't have this technology in them. They don't have the practice to do so. So I think that is, in my opinion, like one of the biggest hurdles, because I also believe that for Bitcoin to be all that it can possibly be, it has to be self-custodied and it has to be decentralized. It has to keep that way. So I think just bringing that technical aspect into very simple terms for most people, or those interface, and I just want to give like an example. For example, here in Mexico, and like a big disclaimer to anyone listening to us right now, I've been here in Mexico for a month, maybe a month and a half now, and I've been kind of shocked to find that unfortunately there's a lot of like limited wallet options when it comes to Bitcoin, especially for Lightning. So the other day I had this Bitcoin family session and I was super excited to show them Blue Wallet, and we created our Bitcoin wallet. It was all fine, but when we got into the Lightning explanation, it was so hard to open a Lightning wallet, because you would have to have your Lightning node and then kind of link them two together through HubSpot. And it was, they would never be able to do that, at least right at this point in time. So I think that bringing just kind of efficiency and people-friendly interfaces really is helping a lot. But we could, talking about self-custody, because exchanges have this, and non-custodial platforms have this. But when it comes to like self-custody, there's like a level of responsibility and a level of technical degree that you have to know. So I think that is probably the biggest hurdle at this point
Interesting. Wow.
in time.
That's a good take, you know? And then I guess
Yeah.
Unchained is, I guess, solving that problem in a big
I
way,
guess
right?
so. I guess
So.
yes. You can tell why they hired me. I do like believed in that, and I believed in that before joining on chain. Like that, and the whole like mining power centralization as well. We need to decentralize mining power, and that is another big one. But I don't think that is a like as big as of a hurdle for adoption, but just for the network to overcome.
Okay,
Yeah.
yeah, for security, decentralization. That makes sense. So, could you explain that problem to the listeners then? The mining centralization, why this is important, and maybe how we can fix it? What's the solution?
I mean, why is it important? And it's all over again. Like I just
And what
it
exactly does
might.
it mean? Sorry, what exactly does it
Oh, that's all
mean?
right. Let me just find you like a good statistic. Well, it's fine. So there's like a lot of mining pools right at this moment, and if you weighed all the mining pools' power together, they're quite huge. So they're over half of the power, I believe, right at this moment in time. It is located in different mining pools, which is not an issue at this point in time, but it's a risk, and it's something that I'm honestly stealing from Matt Odell. He said it first. So the solution is quite simple. It's just more individual mining. So BitAxe is doing a great job with that, I would say. And there's a couple other projects where, if you are solo mining, you're already helping to that issue. And yes, I don't think that it's like we're gonna wake up tomorrow and we're gonna have a 51% attack situation or any of the sorts. But I think we should be a lot more careful when it comes to that, and just more vigilant in that sense.
I'm looking at the chart now, and I remember hearing a stat that it was maybe like the it was a couple of the top five which were from China, but although they're different pools, they actually collaborate together, which is another risk. It's not like one pool needs to have the 51%, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot to it.
Yeah, that's right. And in, for what I'm seeing right now, Boat Foundry and Antpool are like over half of that percentage. So two mining pools have like a big chunk of the mining power on their, well, on their power. And yeah, as I kind of said, it's not the most time sensitive thing, but it, I think it's one of the key things that we're experiencing as new Bitcoiners. Like, I consider myself a new Bitcoiner, so I would say that this is one of the first things that I'm going to have to overcome with the network.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I'm trying to remember this video I watched the other day. I think it was from Matthew Crowder, Bitcoin University. He was actually speaking about this issue. And there's a couple companies who, I mean, I think it's, they have their own mining pool, and you can link your miner to their pool, but they're not the ones who create the block template. So that's like kind of what I've heard seem to be one of the bigger risks associated with mining centralization. The fact that these pools control the template of like the candidate block. So this new company was allowing you to create your own candidate block and connect to their mining pool. Have you heard of something like that?
I think I've kind of heard about it a little bit. It does make sense. I'm also not the best burst when it comes to mining.
Yeah.
But I would say those two issues, which is like self-custody and mining power, are the two things that we just had to open our eyes to at this point in time.
Yeah. What about unequal wealth distribution? So, I mean, with about 95% of all Bitcoin already in circulation and a fraction of the world's population owning a little Bitcoin, is there some worry with just centralization, wealth in a small group of people?
I mean, it really can't be any, it can't be worse than what we see today, right? I think that that's where the 21 million comes into place, and how, open source, this open source, open information protocol, I do think that rich people are going to exist in any kind of society, in any time, place, and space. There's going to be a class difference, and that's my belief. That's kind of what I've seen throughout the years, and etc. But it cannot be worse than the wealth distribution that we see with fiat. Why? Because in a Bitcoin standard, even if people got in early and they huddled a big ton of Bitcoin, people gotta eat. People gotta pay their house. People, if we lived in a Bitcoin standard, those people that actually hold the Bitcoin will eventually have to spend it. Whereas in this fiat standard, we just print it and we give it to the ones they choose. So I would say it's not a concern, both because the economics of it all, like, it will all reach an equilibrium point if we lived in a Bitcoin standard. But besides that, in a fiat standard, there's so much more unfairness to the way we just print money and give it to a certain person. Whereas in Bitcoin, it is all about the value that you make. Like, you're not going to pay someone any Bitcoin if they don't give you value back. I mean, you would if you're actually, not so smart in managing your Bitcoin. But anyone with the right time preference wouldn't just give it away for anything. And whereas in fiat, we just, it costs us nothing to produce money. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll talk a little bit more about fiat versus Bitcoin in a little bit. I wanted to go over a couple more of these, I guess, common concerns, what the fiaters have against Bitcoin, What about, I guess, the capital gains tax? So a lot of people are saying this is just one of the big roadblocks in Bitcoin's way. The fact that it's so hard to actually buy stuff with Bitcoin, because you would need to track when you actually get it at and when you'd sell it at. And there's just capital gains tax. People don't want to deal with that. Is this an issue that you see? And do you ever see a world where developed nations like, I guess, Canada or the States get rid of cap gains tax for Bitcoin?
I think for the States, I think it might come sooner than I would think or would have thought maybe a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I think Trump said something kind of recently, didn't he?
I believe so. And I'm not too, I haven't pinpointed the exact words, but I think it's going to ease up in the States specifically. But yeah, you're right. For example, I don't think it depends on the politics in Canada. But as it's going right now, I don't think Canada would pull back that capital gains tax on Bitcoin. And I think that is not a Bitcoin network problem. It's a politics problem. And then I would kind of tell you, how much do you value living in the country or jurisdiction that you are living right now? And Ooh. Where do you think it's going, considering there's this control over you in your savings, in this case? Like, what else do you think your current government or jurisdiction has control over you? And do you want to be a part of that? I think the lucky thing about Bitcoin, as more and more nations adopt it, and they're, the nations that maybe haven't been on top in the last 100 years, but the way I kind of say it often is like, most of the world, it feels like it's kind of coming down and it's diminishing. Like, there's so much inflation and insecurity rates going up and social unrest and stuff like that. Like, most countries seem to be going downhill. But then there's the Bitcoin countries, and they're the only ones who are going up. Like, they got better security now. They got the better economy. People are able to save. They have international infrastructure going that way. Well, that's kind of my recommendation when it comes to that. It's not specifically about Bitcoin. It's all about how much control does your government has over you, and do you want to stay that way?
Yeah, that's a good point. You think about El Salvador, and they completely made a 180. Now, honestly, I think El Salvador is pretty high up on my travel list.
Oh, mine
as well. I would totally want to visit.
Exactly. No, exactly. And honestly, El Salvador, like, there's views, there's different views. There's people who really do not like El Salvador's new policies and stuff like that. But being from Mexico and kind of experiencing how unsafe it is, like how scary it is to go outside on your own or take a cab as a woman on my own, I just wish that happened here. Like, I just wish.
Yeah.
The economy got better and I went out and it was safe. That's all.
Which part of Mexico are you from?
So I grew up in this little beach town called Acapulco, which at times was the most unsafe place in the world.
Oh my gosh.
but at this point in time, I'm looking in Mexico City. So it's a lot nicer.
Yeah. I guess thinking a little bit more about government, is there anything else that the government could do to really affect the industry? Like, I mean, we see in China that, I don't know exactly what they did. I think they just banned personal ownership of Bitcoin, or you might know better than I do, but what else could the government do to set Bitcoin back?
That's a great example. And honestly, I am not well versed about it, but there's this book titled Would Mao Hold Bitcoin? And it's a very detailed, specific book on Bitcoin in China. It's actually quite impressive, but I'm not too well versed on it. I think that when it comes to government control, like what else could they do against Bitcoin? Really, it would just come to fiscal force, right? Like, I think that if they're, besides capital gains tax and besides making, you know, if you're not able to hold Bitcoin anymore kind of publicly, it would have to be physically enforced to kind of stop Bitcoin where you're at. Like, if you have your two key, if you have your key, your private key, there's literally no other way but beating you to say it out loud, and it really comes down to you, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that's why self-custody is that important, right? Because if the government really does want to crack down on Bitcoin, the easiest thing they can crack down on is a big company who's custodying your Bitcoin for you, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, we've seen, you know, thousands of hundreds of dollars getting lost or accidentally. They've been. I'm so sorry. The word didn't came into my mind, but
it's
pretty much
good.
Just lost or seized by exchanges. Like, there's been literally hundreds of thousands of dollars already lost to exchanges for Bitcoin, and that doesn't count the many schemes and that exist out there that involve Bitcoin. So yeah, you gotta be safe, you gotta do your research, and yeah, I'm a big self-custody advocate, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, let me ask you a question. So, getting more into the economic side, as an economic student, former, I imagine you've learned a lot about Keynesian economics. And through your study of Bitcoin, I imagine you've learned a lot about Austrian economics. So for the listeners, could you explain the differences between these two economic models?
Sure. I think that the way I would explain it in simple terms is that Keynesian economics has already an end goal, and it just tries to prove how that end goal is achieved. Well, Austrian economics is just based in physics, and it's more mathematically and sound than Keynesian can be, because Keynesian just is pretty much trying to prove a social point, which is the state's intervention in the economy.
Yeah, yeah, well said. So explain that a little bit farther, how Austrian economics is, I guess, based on physics, you said?
Yeah, it's what we can call kind of sound theory of money. So it weights in the inflows and outflows, and it weights, you know, the real equilibriums of these outcomes. It's not just trying to tilt it a certain way in that way. You know, math, for example, we can't say like, oh, 2 + 2 = 6. Sorry, I wanted that. Like, that's the same way in Austrian economics. It's like, if this happens, you can't change the outcome. Whereas in Keynesian economics, it's like, oh, well, I don't know. I wanted to give you a more concise example here.
The Keynesian would see 6 first, and then try to prove that 2 + 2
exactly
equals 6. They move the numbers around or whatever,
exactly.
You know?
Or what if we add this other thing that is coming from the printer there? Like,
yeah,
exactly.
Interesting. So were most of your economic classes pushing Keynesian theory?
Oh, yes, 100%. And, you know, it's very silly. I had good teachers, and I had kind of average teachers every once in a while. Keynesian economics doesn't really leave a lot of room to question within the academic space. So, you know, you might ask yourself, like, oh, well, why does inflation happen if, you know, I said that wrong. So you might ask yourself, like, well, you know what, like, inflation is happening, and at the same time we're printing all this money, but this person who's teaching me is saying that the producer, for example, added something in or is trying to do something else. And you say, like, hey, but doesn't this, you know, money printing has any relationship with what is going on? And they would just be super quick to dismiss any other alternative. Like, it is what it is, because that's the way it is. And it's very hard to question academic economics. Yeah, don't recall having a good time.
So when did you, I guess, make that switch when you realize, oh, maybe maybe this isn't the best theory of economics? When did you make that switch? Because most university students have no idea. They just eat what they're being told.
Exactly. I mean, I definitely ate what I was told for the sake of kind of finishing my degree and getting over with it. But I do, that's kind of why I mentioned the previous state, which was very flimsy, and I just can't remember the specific little things, but I remember questioning a lot. Like, I had so many questions throughout the courses, and at some point mid-course, I stopped asking them. I would just write them down and find them out on my own, because I knew that the answer was just going to be, well, it's just the way it is. So, yeah, just having that many questions unanswered left me with, like, this unease of, like, there's something missing. And that's kind of when I realized, like, hey, this isn't going to make an actual change, because if everything just is the way it is because it is, then where's the progress there? So I think that feeling like that and lining up with my friend getting into Bitcoin was almost like a miracle of itself, because that's the way it clicked. And I read Economics in One Lesson very shortly after. And I mean, that should be the book that economics students start with in their journey. If I had a school, Economics in One Lesson is the book that I would give everybody.
Who's that by?
Oh, give me 1 second. I'm so sorry. I'm failing. This is so iconic.
All good. All good.
It is Henry Hazlitt. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's super
old. I
honestly
haven't heard of it, but
it's super old, like older than Bitcoin, and it's this short. It's very, very nice.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I think another good analogy for Keynesian economics is, I guess, like the pharmaceutical industry. So stick with me, but the Bitcoiner wants to just go all natural. They might have a disease that comes, but if they're healthy enough, it'll come and go. But the Keynesian might get the disease and then they want to pop a pill. Oh, this pill might help with it. Uh-oh, this pill gives a side effect. Let me micromanage again. Let me go in and take another pill. Let me raise interest rates, you know? I got to get this surgery now. You know, it's that type of micromanaging. So. I got a whole bunch to learn, but I like that analogy.
You couldn't say it more perfectly, and that's exactly what happens. It's just like they've kind of thinned out trying to prove their point at this point. It's like, how much longer do you actually can sustain this system? Yeah. We're about to find out.
Yeah. So do you think eventually the dollar is going to zero?
In my lifetime, and I might be too bearish for it, I don't think that in my lifetime it will. I think there's still a lot of interest in the dollar. With that said, I do think it's going to keep inflating, and that inflation is going to go straight into hard assets like Bitcoin, like maybe other assets, other
maybe Dogecoin.
Tokens.
my gosh.
But mostly Bitcoin. I don't think it's going to zero, but I think Bitcoin will keep appreciating against it for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. So would you say that a part of fiat theory is that the currency will eventually go to zero? It's programmed.
Yeah,
is that just a guarantee of fiat?
Well, you know, I'm not all mighty and powerful, and I might not know everything, but every single other fiat, history wise, this is the longest that we've ever like maintain under a fiat standard. So I think that history is going to show us a lesson. I have no idea how it's going to play out. And I don't think it's going to be within my lifetime that I'm going to see a zero USD. But I do think that's where we are inevitably going to head out. And all I can hope for is that I do my job well enough that Bitcoin is the one currency that stays. That's about it. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me ask, why do you think schools push Keynesian economics?
Oh, man.
Let's put on our tinfoil hats.
Uh-huh.
Let's get
as
deep
institutions,
here.
It makes sense, right? And especially because I think that I don't know. I'm such a conspiracy theorist right now, but I mean, Bitcoin has such a big pushback from the media and big bodies in the government and blah blah blah. So do I think that Keynesian economics is done in schools strategically as a conspiracy to make everybody kind of fit in the system? And yes, I do believe in that. But at the same time, I think that at this point, it kind of became a self-fulfilling prophecy, because ultimately, you know, the teachers that are teaching economics out there, they were students once, and maybe they don't even realize or have that like practice to question their own knowledge. So now that they get to teach, they get to teach the version they know. And so I think partly it's strategic and partly it's just a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah. Interesting. Because I remember hearing Matthew Vuk, mm-hmm. shout out him.
Yeah, I love the man.
Yeah. But he explained this pretty well to me one time, and he said that, yeah, like these economics professors and these professors at schools were once economics students, and they were taught this type of theory. And it's so hard to try to change someone's mind once they've already been programmed, you know? And to come and say to an economics prof, hey, everything you've learned over your entire career isn't the right way to do it. No one's going to take that well, you know? So,
no.
Yeah.
No, exactly. Literally, it's an identity thing. Like, if you identify as a Keynesian economist, that's all you are. So, yeah. And, like, yeah, as I've said, like, I had great teachers that I actually care a lot about, and we had a great time in school. But they won't ever listen to anything about Bitcoin. It doesn't matter how good my argument is. It doesn't matter how backed my argument is. They won't look into it at all, which is just sad, because they're, you know, they have a lot of influence in younger generations, and they had a lot of influence in me. So kind of hard to see, but it is what it is.
We will be
the next teachers anyway.
Absolutely. Be the change you want to see in the world. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what would you say to the proponent of Keynesian economics who says a deflationary currency like Bitcoin, so that's one whose supply will decrease over time, will never work, because without inflation, people will hoard their money, and as such, businesses fail, and you go into this deflationary death spiral. And everyone
I love
dies.
This argument.
What do you
I
say?
I love this argument. It really is like, hey, like they really are saying like, hey, people, they're not going to eat today because their hot dog is going to be 10 cents less tomorrow. Like, they're so going to starve for today. And no, that's not the reality. Like, people got to eat. People got to pay bills. People get sick one day and they got to pay a hospital. There's like, people have wants, people want to travel, people love nice new shiny phones. And so money is going to be spent. No, it's not going to be hoarded because it just can't be. It's not human nature. It's one of my, just, I love that argument, because like, we're all going to be holding our Bitcoin and owning nothing, which is a big maxi thing to do right now. But if we lived in a Bitcoin standard, no one would do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Imagine telling your daughter, oh, it's your birthday? Sorry, no gifts for you because we need to hold our Bitcoin. It's going to be worth more in the future.
I know. And at that time, like if we do get to that time, the appreciation is not going to be like $10,000 tomorrow. It's just going to be, maybe a couple cents, a couple things down if we do get to that scale. So yeah, it's a perfect example. It's like we only have birthdays once a year. We're not going to wait until next year or so. Yeah.
Yeah. And you also hear that, I mean, just speaking with other Bitcoiners who I've asked this question to, they've said that it's just going to lead to a more productive society. People will probably be a little bit more thoughtful with how they spend their money. And as such, there's people have to innovate that much more to get the Bitcoin, you know? So it's interesting. Have you heard much about the different periods in history when there was deflation? Because to be honest, I've heard proponents of fiat, proponents of inflation, speak about these times in history when we've seen deflation and it did lead to this death spiral. I haven't done much research. I'm wondering if you have, but like there's periods in history where there was deflation. Some people say people thrived during that time. Others say people didn't.
I will not lie. I'm not going to, pull out something I don't know. I am not the most specific person when it comes to that, but I believe the reason this failed, like the reason that deflation failed at those points in time is because it either came at an inflationary time or it came right after. So for example, when we try to go back to the gold standard after World War One was happening and the currencies in Europe were inflated, when we came back after that inflationary period, it was obviously going to be a little chaotic and completely chaotic situation. The only reason this happened was because it was right after this super inflationary period. So yes, and it said we cannot have deflation in an inflationary system because it is bad. But if deflation is designed in the system, then it does incentivize human progress. That's my thought.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. And then I also heard someone say, most people today are financially illiterate. They don't even know that there's, like what we're told, the 3% inflation, which is probably a little higher, People don't even know about that. A lot of people don't. So what you think it's really going to change if a deflationary standard, like a Bitcoin standard, were to come in place? Would people actually be that aware of their finances where they're just going to start hoarding their money? Because most people don't. Like,
that's
they just don't
question.
Know what's going on.
And I think there's going to be societies where no, people are definitely not going to wake up. And, and honestly, and this is, again, a lot of conspiracy and my forecast, this is not necessarily true. But I do think that it's going to be kind of privileged societies that come to it last. Because ultimately, we are seeing that education shift in those countries that have a better Bitcoin adoption. And we see, and again, El Salvador is just very cute to me to think about it because their public schools kind of look like the public schools here in Mexico. But here in Mexico, no one knows about Bitcoin and no one knows about inflation. At least that's my perspective here. But they get like finance classes and Bitcoin classes and like that change is already happening elsewhere. But I think that there is this kind of like privileged price that a lot of societies are paying right now because, well, they have enough money to be able to still afford rent next month and to still go do their grocery shops. And they might start to notice a little inflation, but they don't feel it that urgent yet. And so I think it's kind of like that boiling pot with a frog in it situation where
I was thinking about that. Yeah.
Whoever jumps last is going to stay there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So has Mexico ever mentioned anything about Bitcoin? Oh,
we had a government official that went to Nashville to Bitcoin 2024, but then she turned out to be a little bit of a spy, and now she's involved in a CBDC project.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. That's so mean. And I'm going to struggle finding Bitcoin here in Mexico, and there's no mention of it politically, but I do know that there's a couple good Bitcoin projects here. For example, like La Casa de Satoshi in Mexico City. There's
what's it called?
La Casa de Satoshi.
La Casa, Satoshi's house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
They're awesome. I think that they're probably like the biggest Bitcoin community here. But other than them, I haven't found anyone.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, yeah, I do, like, in my mind, I think eventually a lot of these like developing nations are just going to have leaders who build their whole campaign behind Bitcoin, you know? I mean, we've seen that in, you would probably know the countries better than I could. Obviously, El Salvador, Suriname, Bhutan, like all these leaders had their campaign. Even Trump, that was a yeah. large portion of his campaign, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah, I see that is the way to go. I cannot stress enough how much I wish that was the case for my country sooner than later. I want to live the Bitcoin benefits before I have to leave this world. So,
yeah.
Yes, maybe we'll run for candidate one day. Who knows?
maybe. Wow. Okay. I mean, honestly, just wrapping up here. What would you say to the average investor looking to get into Bitcoin? They might not know much, but they have some money that they're ready to deploy.
Totally. At this moment in time, and I know my answer is going to be quite lame, but because it's catered for an investor, I would say first, watch what Trump and his board members, you know, JFK, Cynthia Loomis, are saying about Bitcoin, and think about that's going to be our like the administration for the next 4 years. And secondly, because there's the second that I say Bitcoin to any investor is it's too volatile, I will just suggest to look up what is upward volatility, and that is exactly what Bitcoin is.
Okay. Yeah, honestly, I think I'd probably just recommend learning as much as you can, you know?
I know. It's just sad that people don't like to learn sometimes. Have you seen that meme that's like, when to buy, when to sell? And it's like a long, long line of people. And then it's like, learn Bitcoin. And there's no one standing in that post. That's how I feel these days.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, people are always going to be into that quick money. And that's why crypto, meme coins, or I guess that appealing, you know? Do you think that meme coins are going to be around forever and that side of the space? Or is that all going to go to zero relative to Bitcoin?
I do think meme coins are going to go to zero. And you know what? I was a little bit of a defender for Ethereum. I always said like, hey, I see the use case for it. I see it has a space in the world. And now it's kind of really, really dropping. And, you know, I see all the roast on Twitter and I kind of start to agree with them.
Yeah.
So I do think eventually meme coins will tank to zero. But for the meantime, you know, as long as the printer's still printing and we don't have the education necessary, there's going to be some meme coins that rise in value for no reason, and sometimes it's worth to be around for them.
Yeah. With the goal of putting it all into Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, that would be my goal. I respect any other goal. You know, if you gotta lose to learn that Bitcoin's the way, that is also a good goal there. It's also fine.
Okay. Well, Daniela, thank you very much. I think this was an awesome talk. And seriously, you're pushing this industry forward. You're on the right side. So congratulations. I'll link all your social medias below. Do you have any final messages?
Honestly, I really just wanted to thank you for having me again. It really is an honor to be one of your first guests here, and I wish you all the success in the world. And to anyone listening, also follow Spencer and follow with all the following episodes that there's going to be. It's going to be a great one.
Oh, yeah. You'll be back eventually.
Oh, I would love that. And I'll be way more prepared for that as well.
All right. You have a good one.
Okay. Bye, Spencer.
Bye.